If I tell you my whole testimony, it'll be filled of faithlessness, screw-ups, complete disobedience to God, right? And I'm not talking 10 years ago. But if I tell my testimony from the perspective of God, it's full of success and faithfulness.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to the Living Hope Podcast, an outreach of Living Hope Church located at 352 Charles Hoke Road, Whitney, Pennsylvania. Please stay tuned to the end to hear a closing message from Pastor Doug. Now, let's join Pastor Doug as he shares from the Word of God.
Well, praise the Lord. At this time, I want to ask Randy and Jessica to come up, and they're going to steward the veterans honoring portion of the service today. And there's one of them. There's the other one. I started looking around. I'm like, I hope they didn't try to beat everybody to the buffet. That would have really been bad. All right. Thank you very much, guys.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just learned how to operate this microphone for the first time this morning, so I'm glad I did good.
What?
We just want to welcome everybody again today. It's just a great day to be in the house of the Lord. I'm overwhelmed with everybody that's here today. It's awesome to see everybody. And we just, you know, love Veterans Day. We love veterans. You know, I'm a little biased because my husband is a veteran and just retired, but we just thank... We just thank everybody for their service, but I know while I was worshiping, I just felt like everybody in this room is a soldier. We are all part of God's army, and these are just the days that we need to engage and not retreat. So we just need to all stand strong as soldiers in God's army. Okay, we just have a brief little video. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have something to say?
So I just wanted to say, you know, when we were worshiping there, one of the things that came to me was, back to my beginning days when I was in the infantry, they used to take people to RTO, be RTOs for the company commanders, right? And you had to carry his everything, his map markers, all of his maps, the radio. You stayed up all night on the radio, you know, broadcasting everything that was going on in the battlefield, blah, blah, blah. So fast forward to right now, we were just sitting here worshiping, and I turned to my wife and I said, I don't know the order of service this morning. I don't know who I'm supposed to be introducing, what I'm supposed to be saying, nothing. She's like, I got you, babe. I got you. So that reminded me of my RTO days whenever the commander would be like, hey, where's my stuff, this, where's my that, where's my this? I got you, sir. I got you. Don't worry about it. I'm taking care of it. So hats off to you.
Well, thank you. I do have you, but we're just going to play just a brief video that was on the History Channel of what is Veterans Day.
Soldiers from wars both old and new march down city streets. Flags hang from homes, businesses, even car antennas. Ceremonies remember those who dutifully served their nation. It's Veterans Day, or Remembrance Day, as it's known in much of the world, a time to honor members of the armed forces. And it all began in a railroad car with a document to end the war, to end all wars. World War I, also known as the Great War, shocked the global community with its unprecedented toll in human life. Untold millions were killed. Germany was running low on manpower and supplies, so they agreed to sign an armistice, or truce, in the French commander Ferdinand Foch's private rail car. On the 11th hour, on the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, all was quiet on the Western Front. The fighting had ended. Exactly 1 year later, President Woodrow Wilson decreed that Americans should observe a moment of silence at 11 a.m., to remember the armistice and to embrace the peace. Other Allied nations commemorated the peaceful anniversary as well. In England and Canada, citizens wore paper poppies. Poppies had become a symbol of the armistice. The poem Flanders Field described a one-time battlefield. In Flanders Field, the poppies blow between the crosses row on row. In America, the nation's first unknown soldier was laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery on Armistice Day, 1921. He was a casualty of the Great War. Since that first memorial, other unknown soldiers from America's wars have been interred in the tomb. And it's become tradition for the president or one of his representatives to lay a wreath on the monument every November 11th. A resolution was passed in 1926 inviting all Americans to remember Armistice Day and the soldiers who fought so hard for peace. The idea caught on. By 1938, the day was marked with so many ceremonies and parades, Congress made it a legal holiday, giving people the day off work. After World War II and the Korean War, Americans wanted to open up the holiday to include not just World War I veterans, but all who served in combat. In 1954, President Dwight Eisenhower, a World War II vet himself, legally changed the U.S. Armistice Day to Veterans Day, honoring those who served in all American wars. For a brief time, starting in 1971, Congress moved the holiday to the fourth Monday in October, giving Americans a three-day weekend. But most people rejected the idea. The traditional date of November 11th, the anniversary of the Great War's ceasefire, was too historically important to forget. President Ford reversed the law in 1975, returning Veterans Day back to its rightful date. Over the decades, the holiday has changed with the times. Originally, it was a call for world peace. Then, in the U.S., it became a day to remember war veterans. Today, Veterans Day is set aside to honor not just those who served in war, but also those who have served their nation in peace.
All right, and at this time, we have Casey, who is our youth ministry leader here, and his kids are going to come in and...
We're working on it.
Stretch it out.
We're having technical difficulties.
There you go. There they come. Welcome, welcome. Yes, and Casey, our youth ministry leader here, is also a veteran himself. Yes. All right.
All right. Everyone, please stand while we say the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty, justice for all. Thank you. Turn around, go that way.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. We bless our children here. You know they are the future of Living Hope Church. All right, and at this time, we have Jackie, who is...
No? We don't have Jackie.
Video? Oh, at this time we are going to play a video. Well, I didn't realize.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again. Just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, 'cause the flag still stands for freedom and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that
from the lakes of Minnesota to the hills of Tennessee, across the plains of Texas, from sea to shining sea, from Detroit down to Houston and New York to LA, where there's pride in every American heart, and it's time we stand and say,
song is just always powerful every time you listen to it, because I mean, it, you know, it is the truth. We, our flag still stands for freedom. No matter what is going on today, we are free in this country, and our flag stands for that freedom. And like I said before, this is a time we need to engage. Okay, at this time, we are going to have a presentation by our very own Ann Schilling, who is a Navy veteran herself. Come on up, Ann.
I'm not going to need that.
It's okay.
Lovely. Of all the military bugle calls, none is so easily recognized or render emotion than taps. The melancholy 24 note bugle call known as taps is unique with the United States military, as it gives its melody both powerful and haunting, and the history of its origin is somewhat held in controversy. The use of taps is unique with the United States Armed Forces, since the call is sounded at funerals, wreath laying, and military memorial services, accompanied by guards of honor, the folding of the American flag, and the firing of volley shots as a salute. The military funeral is a memorial burial rite for a Marine, soldier, sailor, Coast Guardsman, or airman who died in battle, a veteran, or other prominent military figure, or the president. Our present-day taps was made during the American Civil War by a Union general, Daniel Adams Butterfield, heading a brigade camped at Harrison Landing, Virginia, near Richmond. Taps is thought to be a revision of a French bugle signal called tattoo that notified soldiers to cease in the evening drinking and return to their forts. It was sounded an hour before the final bugle call to end the day by extinguishing fires and lights. The last five measures of tattoo resemble taps. The word taps is an alteration of my obsolete word tattoo, derived from the Dutch tattoo, as a command to shut or tap the keg. General Butterfield decided lights out music was too formal to signal the day's end. One day, July 1862, he recalled the tattoo music and hummed a version of it to an aide who wrote it down in music. Butterfield then asked the brigade bugler, Oliver Norton, to play the notes, and after listening, lengthened and shortened the whole them while keeping the original melody. He ordered Norton to play this new call at the end of each day thereafter instead of the regulation call. The music was heard and appreciated by other brigades who adopted this bugle call and was even adopted by Confederate buglers. This music was made the official Army bugle call after the war, but not given the name Taps until 1874. Stories of the origin exist. Butterfield's role gives him a place in history of music and war. The first time Taps was played at a military funeral may also have been in Virginia soon after Butterfield composed it. Union Captain John Tidball, head of an artillery battery, ordered it played for a funeral of a cannoneer killed in action. Not wanting to reveal the battery's position in the woods to the nearby enemy, Tidball substituted Taps for the traditional three rifle volleys over the grave. Taps was played at the funeral of Confederate General Stonewall Jackson 10 months after it was composed. Army infantry regulations by 1891 required Taps to be played at military funeral ceremonies. The new bugle signal, also known as Butterfield's lullaby, is called Taps in common uses because it was used the same purpose to signal lights out. However, the United States Army did not officially change the name to Taps until 1891. As soon as Taps was sounded that night, July 1862, words were put to with the music. The first were, "Go to sleep." As years went on, many more versions were created. Another version was a poem written by Henry Longsworth Longfellow called "The Day Is Done." The version I feel mostly resembled the melody of Taps, music written by Butterfield and lyrics by Horace Lorenzo Trim, is called Taps. There are three verses. The first is, "Day is done, gone the sun, from the lakes, from the hills, from the sky, all is well, safely rest, God is nigh." Today, the sounding of taps is played often by a lone bugler, or perhaps by two in echo fashion, provided that it is made available by the United States Armed Forces. Since so few buglers are available today or cannot be provided by the military, Taps is then played by auto recording.
Thank you, Anne. That was a great presentation, and we thank you for your service and your heart, too. Okay. All right. So what? And Anne is also the widow of a Marine, so we thank him for his service, too. All right.
So that's Taps. That just we were just talking about this. Chokes me up. I love the song. It's one of them, like, love-hate relationships for me because it means... The things it means is just unbelievable. So everybody in their life has somebody that they confide in, that they rely on, that they hear the words from. I have been so blessed in my life to have several, but this next gentleman and his family that is coming up, his wife Shannon, that are coming up, every time I talk to him, I hear a different word. I hear something. You just feel the Holy Spirit just coming from them. As soon as you start talking to them, having them in your life, it's just amazing. He has opened up so many different doors to me that I didn't even know were available. And I don't even think he knows that he did that in the little conversations that we have. Because a lot of times we're at work and we're discussing things and he's giving me some revelations and things he heard. And then it's like, oh, I got a meeting. Oh, I got to go here. Oh, I got to go here. We're always so busy. But he just, I'm just honored to know this man. I'm honored to call him my friend. I'd like to introduce, please welcome Lieutenant Colonel Doug Harsh and his wife Shannon.
Thanks, man. I got you, sir. Just complete evidence that perfection is not a requirement to be used by God. I remember one time I was doing the announcements at my church, and the song kind of, the worship team came to a low, and I came up and I started walking across the podium, and then the worship leader went into another chorus, and I just kept walking and went down the other side. So, Randy, I didn't know we were that good of friends. No, I'm just joking. I love Randy. His quality. His mom and dad did a good job with him. On behalf of me and my wife, thank you so much for the honor to come and speak to you guys today. This actually fulfills something that God showed me over 10 years ago. He showed me and my wife actually speaking together on stage. I'm an evangelist. I go and preach, so I do it on a regular basis. But he showed me and her, and it's kind of crazy as I saw that area right there, and it was empty. So my wife does not like to public speak, so that should tell you her heart. That should tell you her heart for her ministry and what she wants to do. I tell you, you guys, you have the nice church, you have the great location, you got the funny pastor, but the most important thing that you guys have in here is that you've cultivated an atmosphere to welcome God. And it's very evident that the Spirit of God is in this place. And when you guys all came up to worship, I couldn't even talk, man, it was awesome, right? He just dropped. So awesome for having hearts like that. I pat you on the back and just encourage you to cultivate that and keep that going. So my wife is a lot tougher and stronger than I am by far, right? Evidence of four kids sitting over there. But her heart has always been in the pro-life arena. And instead of really pro-life, it's like anti-abortion is what she does. She has just got hired as the new director of Choices Pregnancy Center. They opened up a new office in Southside, Pittsburgh. And she's going to share her heart with you a little bit today and what she does.
Yay. This is my first time speaking. First time. So if I stumble, this is what you get. He did it first, that's right. So I started volunteering for Choices when we lived here in 2013, 14, 16. And then we moved a couple times and I worked for a center in Missouri, and I worked for a center in New Jersey, and I kept in contact with our center here, and God brought us back and gave me a position at our new center. We just opened up 2 weeks ago. We have a center in Coriopolis, a center in Beaver Valley, and then the new Southside. We have two ICU mobile units that travel throughout all of Beaver County and all of Pittsburgh. Actually, on Saturdays, we park in front of Planned Parenthood, Allegheny Health, and McGee Hospitals, where they are still performing abortions up to 24 weeks. The 40 Days of Life group are usually out there, and will go back and forth between us and the abortion centers and saving the mamas and the babies. So, one reason that Choices is very close to my heart is at one time I was that young mom facing unplanned pregnancy and no support and lots of fear, and it's hard being in that spot. And I wish I had a place like Choices to go to. So now we have the opportunity to do that, and we help people all the time that their family's not supportive or their boyfriends aren't supportive and they're trying to push them into abortion, and once they know that they're loved and they have our support, they end up choosing life. Actually, this morning I was talking to one of my clients, and she is in the same spot. Her boyfriend lives with them, and he's trying to force her into an abortion, and she's like 16. So that's like as old as my oldest kid, right? So it's rough sometimes. And I was talking to her this morning, and then she's coming to my center on Tuesday. So that's awesome, right? So now instead of facing abortion, she's getting to walk through life. And we have pregnancy classes and prenatal classes and education, and we do STD testing. We do post-abortion healing ministry, which is so important because women who go through this stuff, they just aren't told this from the beginning. We go through options counseling when, again, Planned Parenthood does not tell you what really happens. They don't. So if that's one thing that brings them in the door, is that we get to tell them the truth, you know, God's truth about what goes on, and that is life from like the very beginning, then we're doing our job and the rest is up to Him. So I'm going past my notes. So Choices has served over 1,000 clients, men and women, in all of our locations every single year. We've been open since 1987, and those numbers are just growing. We do STD testing for men and women. We do options counseling. We do prenatal education and parenting classes for the dads, too, because it's a family unit. It's not just about the babies and the mamas. It's about the whole family, and we want to get them involved, you know. So we take time with each of those clients that come in, male or female. You know, they're all going through something, and we just want to meet them where they're at. And oftentimes they come back to us, you know, even if it's just a pregnancy test now, maybe they come back to us for something later, education classes, STD testing, whatever. They end up maintaining that relationship with us, so it's important to start that from day one. So how can you guys help? You can pray. I have a sign-up sheet where we do weekly prayer alerts every week, so you can go the specific needs for what we're facing that week. Volunteering. We're just starting to do volunteers again after all this crazy COVID. Actually, my center is only about 45 minutes away from where you guys are right now, so that's not too bad. Or you can donate. I have some pamphlets with that information also. And our annual banquet is this coming Thursday. It's actually going to be held virtually, so that's a benefit to you guys because you can sign up online and watch it from home and see what we're about more and get involved more. And there's a link up there, hopefully.
Yeah.
That's awesome. There's a link up there to register so that you can have the link the night of. Watch it by yourself or watch it with a group. I think that's all I got. So thanks for letting me share. If you have any questions, I'll be around.
So the Lord showed me a long time ago that my wife's ministry was greater than mine. And that, yeah, right. And she doesn't save babies, that she saves generations, right? So it's pretty awesome. So, yeah. So it was kind of awkward when I first got here. Your pastor walked up to me. You know, he was in the Army, and he was a sergeant, right? And he walks up to me, and he introduces himself, and I say, hey, how you doing? And he looks at me, and he says, listen, I know you're a colonel, but don't confuse your rank with my authority, all right? No, he didn't say that. He didn't say that. I think he wanted to, but he didn't. Okay. So I'll give you I'm gonna give you two disclaimers here before I start speaking. Number one, when you hear me say that I healed someone or I performed a miracle, I completely and absolutely understand that it is him who is in me that does that stuff. Just like Jesus said in the book of John, right, that I can do nothing apart from him. And I just acknowledge that I am his hands and his feet and that he operates through me to do those things. So when you hear that, sometimes religion likes to jump up and be like, oh, you can't say that. Well, Paul called it his ministry, right? His gospel. So I think we have to personalize those. And the second one is you're more likely going to see me cry. I don't say it arrogantly. I am a tough guy. I have been tried on more than once, and I have been found sufficient. I've only lost two fights in my life. The first time I fought a larger-than-me guy in a bar in Fairmont, West Virginia, and that is why my... And that is why my nose goes this way. So if you ever look at me, it goes to the left. And the second fight I lost was to Jesus, and that's why I'm standing here, right? So that's good. I'm from West Virginia. My dad was a Appalachian Church of God evangelist. If you don't know what Appalachian Church of God, that is Jesus loves you, but be careful, you're one step from hell, right? So they didn't have a good understanding of grace and the gospel and things of that in a way, even though I saw my dad perform lots of miracles and he truly loved the Lord. I got saved when I was like 13. At least I thought I did, right? So I was down in Virginia and some Appalachian preacher slapped me in the head and I fell backwards and he stood over me and told me to speak in tongues and I said something just to get him out of my face. But I was like, I don't know what that is, but there was definitely a change in me that day until I was about 17. Graduated high school, and I turned 18 on December 20th. I joined the Army January 20th, and I was out the door and did not serve the Lord anymore. I'm getting ready to come up on, in January, we'll make 30 years of service, and this is our retirement move, so you can tell how long ago that was. I went on my first deployment in 2004. I went to, in the 90s, I spent lots of times down in Central America, things of that nature. We worked with the 7th Special Forces Group out of Fort Bragg. I'm a military policeman by trade. I was enlisted at the time. We would do humanitarian missions. We would go down into different countries in Central America. And our job was to link in with either the local national police or the host nation military police to provide security. And then the special forces guys would bring doctors and veterinarians and dental workers and stuff like that. And we'd go into the mountains and provide health care and things of that nature. came out of that, and the wars kicked off in 2002. I was the recipient of a direct commission, which I went from being a sergeant to an officer in 90 days because they needed military police officers. So I applied, became an officer, became a second lieutenant. My first deployment was in 04. It was down to Guantanamo Bay. That's when the wars were really kicking off. I had a cousin that was in the Special Forces Group out of Bragg. He was in Afghanistan at the time, and me and him used to joke. I wonder how many of those guys he was, like, capturing. And then we would pick them up on planes and take them over, and they would go through interrogations and things of that nature. That was the first time I had really come face-to-face with what I call true evil. I'd been shot at before and things of that nature, and people hated me. It was the first time that I actually got to look my enemy face to face and know that he really, really wanted to kill me. Like, he, just for being white, for being a Christian, for being an American, he wanted to do me out, right? And it was very violent. It was a very violent tour. We had to deal with those guys on a regular basis, and I still wasn't living for the Lord. I still wasn't coming back to him, even though I can tell you that he was, I always had a notion that he was there. I came back from that first deployment. I was very burned out, And one of my best friends said, hey, why don't you move in with me? And I can get you a job at the Sheriff's Department in Morgantown, West Virginia. So I did that. And I was working there part-time. And I was still going out a lot, drinking a lot, things of that nature. And I knew the Lord was calling me. I couldn't deny it. And I remember saying to the Lord, if you want me to serve you, you have to get me out of Morgantown, West Virginia, because there's too many hooks in me. Okay, let's just be, I'm a realist with God, right? I'm like, this is how it is. Within like 3 or 4 days, I got a phone call from the Army saying, hey, we need a military police captain to deploy with this unit out in Allentown, Pennsylvania. We want to pull you back onto active duty. I was like, oh, sure, that sounds great to me. So they, within a couple of days, I had orders. I moved to Allentown, Pennsylvania. And they promoted me to captain, and I walked into a Red Cross to get my guys certified on CPR and things like that, and there was this girl sitting at the reception desk over here. So I will tell you, if you are single, I will tell you, my wife will tell you from her perspective, she was sitting there, she heard the elevator, she looked up, she saw me, she said, oh my God. And her coworker said, what's wrong? And she goes, God just said, here comes the guy you're going to marry. Me and my wife went on probably 6 or 8 dates. I'd been praying. At this time, I'd actually had went back to church and had a very powerful experience with God. But I was still kind of, that old life was going out and drinking, was still pulling me. But I was, at least I was going to church on Sunday. You know, it was a pattern. So, but I'd been praying for him to send me my Eve. And I was knelt down in my bedroom, and I was praying, Lord, is this the woman you want me to marry? And I heard, I answered your prayers. I sent her to you. What else do you want? And I popped my head up, and I looked around the room, and then I convinced myself that I just thought that. So I put, I'm not the brightest one, right? So I put my head back down. I'm like, no, seriously, is this who I'm supposed to marry? And I heard, I answered your prayer. I sent her to you. What else do you want? I was like, I got it. Went and got an engagement ring, and we got married. We saw each other 6 weeks, our first year of marriage, and 2 weeks was when I came home mid-tour, which I had never should have done because I deployed to Iraq in 08. I came home, did not feel safe, and pretty much spent my whole 2 weeks in my bedroom playing solitaire and on the computer and couldn't wait to go back to country. Came back, actually landed Christmas Eve of 2008, later that year. Loaded her up out of Allentown, Pennsylvania, and we, me, her, and Haley went to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. And so I could go to Captain's Career Course. While I was at Captain's Career Course, I was drinking every single day. I used to have this little ritual where I'd come home, and I was doing my master's degree at the same time, so my day would usually, I'd get up around 4, go to PT, I'd come back, I'd be in class by 7, I'd stay in the Army class all day till around 1700, 5 o'clock, I'd come home for an hour, eat and change, and then I'd 3 nights a week, I'd go to night school from 6 to 10, and then come home. And on the nights that I wasn't like that, I would drink Corona Lights with lemon, and I would watch war movies, and I would get up, when my beer was empty, I'd get up, and I'd come into the kitchen, and I'd put my bottle beside the coffee pot, and I'd walk over here to the refrigerator, and I'd get me another beer, and I just made a circle, and go back out and sit and watch. And I remember one morning I woke up, and 4 o'clock in the morning, and I wasn't drunk, and I wasn't hungover, and I'm getting my cup of coffee, and I sat there and went, 1, 2, 3, 4, 13, 14, 15, 16. And I said, ooh, I might have a problem. There might be something there. Now, mind you, this whole time, we're going to church every Sunday. We're tithing. We're giving. Right? So we're doing all that stuff, right? So that was a breaking point. I'd completely, so when you deploy, we often have this, we call it the emotional switch. You just switch your emotions off. It's very easy. And then I never flipped mine back on. And she suffered for that. And lesser women would have left me, hands down, and would probably have been okay to do that. So God moves us out of there, and he brought us to Westover Air Force Base up in Massachusetts. We were pregnant with Miss Gracie there, number 2, and thought she was going to be a boy. And I kept saying, oh, that's my boy, that's my boy. But my daughter Haley would walk up and rub my wife's belly and say, no, that's my Gracie, that's my Gracie. So we named her Kathleen Grace, and her name's Gracie. God sent us to we ended up in this little Assemblies of God church under Pastor Dan. And that's really where God started really tweaking our lives. We started getting a little bit more serious about our faith. We started growing our faith. It's real funny. I'm still friends with Pastor Dan. I was up here not too long ago, and he just laughs. He's like, you're not the same guy. He's like, I just almost didn't like you when you were here before. I said, I can understand that, because I was arrogant, and I was proud, and I thought I had all the answers, and I thought I knew everything, right? So we left out of there, and we went to Bear Creek, Pennsylvania, where I took command of the 361st Military Police Company, and that's where number three, Jacob, rolled in. And we had him there. All right. And then my dad was going through a lot of medical issues, things of that nature. So I got the Army to send me to Pittsburgh as the anti-terrorism officer and the provost marshal. So provost marshal is a police chief. The morning in 2013 that we were literally getting in the vehicle to drive here, I got a call from my little brother, and my dad had died of a massive heart attack out of nowhere. That one hurt. That one hurt bad because he was my best friend. So we move out here in 2013, and the only thing I can think is, like, God must still have a purpose, right? And, oh, by the way, I'm still drinking. I'm still doing some other things, right, during this time period. So I can only think, like, well, God must have a purpose for this, right? So we started attending this little church. And I'm going to leave out the multiple miscarriages we had in between every kid and all that craziness. But we started attending this little church. Well, not a little church, but they had a house. We were helping the pastor move out of his house on the property. And I remember telling Shannon, I would like to rent that house. It's good location. It's pretty nice and things of that nature. So I prayed and I said, Lord, if you want us to move into that house, let them offer me that house to rent it. And one day, Pastor John called me, and he said, hey, can we talk? I said, yeah. And I went over to Pastor John. He goes, hey, we'd like to hire you as an associate pastor, and we want to offer you this house. And I was like, I said, I would never, ever, ever be a pastor because I don't like people that well. I'm not lying to you. I'm very transparent. I'm very transparent, right? So this is not a story of a guy that got saved and completely changed his life and everything was awesome, right? That is not me at all, right? But I knew, I couldn't deny in that fact that God had said, hey, you know, you're here. So I was like, oh, yeah, sure, we'll do that. And that's really where some of my really big struggles started. I got injured. I was coming out of a building, and I slipped and fell down a flight of stairs and injured my lower left back. I used to run marathons. I used to be about 25 pounds lighter than I am right now. Or half marathons. I used to run 10Ks, 5Ks. I was a very avid runner, and my back went out on me, and I couldn't run anymore. So I didn't know it at the time, but my running was a huge outlet for the PTSD that I have. But I didn't know that I had PTSD, or maybe I had it, but I wasn't willing to admit it, right, because I'm a big, tough guy, and I'm an Army officer, and da-da-da, all this and everything. So I really struggled in the church as a pastor when I would get up and speak to people just like I'm doing now, and I would tell you about God's mercy and God's love and God's grace. And then I felt like a complete hypocrite because I knew the violence that I had visited on my fellow men. And I always used to think, yeah, if you knew what I've done, there'd be no way you'd want me up here, right? So I struggled with that, but I kept it hidden, right? Because for me to go talk to someone about that means that I have to tell you what I've done, right? And I wasn't in that place. So I could not wait to PCS and get away from being a pastor because I didn't want to do it no more. Excuse me. We rotated back to, in 2016, we rotated back down to Fort Leavenworth, Missouri again. So if you wonder why that's always in, that's the home of the military police school. So you're in a long career, you're going to go there multiple times for training and professional development, things of that nature. Was a concept developer, which means that we focused on 2035 and beyond and how does the Army fight its wars. Worst job I ever had, hated it. But my behavior really started taking a change. I went from being a super troop soldier. I didn't want to lead in the church. And we started going to a little church out there. And my job performance went down. I hated being in the Army. I was drinking a lot. I've been a casualty notification officer multiple times, and that's where you have to put on your uniform and go knock on the door and tell them that their loved one's gone. Worst job in the Army, hands down. And I'd been a casualty assistance officer. I had to take that training again while I was at Fort Leonard Wood. I went to that training, and because I was the only officer in the class, I had to kind of sit off to the side by myself, and I was bawling. I couldn't help myself, and I'd have to excuse myself. I'm like, what is going on with me? I didn't know, right? So one day, I'm sitting at work, and I'm so emotionally just overwhelmed. I got up, I looked at my boss, and I said, I got a doctor's appointment and left. Completely lied. I went right to the chaplain's office, and I walked in. And it always makes me think of, it makes me laugh a little bit, because I walked in, I was like, I need to talk to someone. And I just remember going, okay, just a second. You're okay, right? So I can imagine what I looked like. I went in, I sat down with the chaplain. As soon as the chaplain closed the door, I just started bawling. Couldn't even talk. Couldn't even tell you what was going on. So that's when he first opened my eyes, and he said, have you ever dealt with PTSD? Have you ever been diagnosed with that? And I said, no, because there's a very big stigma in the military about having PTSD, those things. It makes you, that you can't handle. Do you know in the Army evaluation for NCOs, for the enlisted, there's actually a block where they get evaluated on their mental toughness. So you have a culture that says how mentally tough are you, how mentally tough are you, can elevate you. But on the side over here, when you're there's a price for visiting violence and having violence visited on you. There's a price to that, right? And the Army doesn't do a very good job of acknowledging that. And just as a side thing, because of this COVID thing, which is not public knowledge really, but suicide rate in the military has jumped 58%, right? So he asked me if I'd ever done PTSD or anything. I said, no, whatever. So we PCS out of there. We go to Joint Base McGuire-Dix-Lakehurst in New Jersey. And I got into my new job and, excuse me. I got into my new job and I was just overwhelmed and I was like, I give up. I went and checked myself into mental health, made an appointment with a counselor. And I came home and Shannon was driving for some reason. I can't remember why, but we pulled up to the house. And I said, hey, I got to tell you something. I said, I'm not okay. I said, I checked myself into mental health today. And she looks at me and goes, you think? So I knew my tripping point was whenever the kids left the cereal, you know, like you need pour cereal if you don't, like, put the cellophane back down over and push the bag down under like normal people, right? And I took that box and I zinged it across the zinged it across my kitchen towards the dining room table towards them. And, So, once again, I went to counseling. Didn't tell my command at all because I didn't want that stigma. And the counselor asked me, why are you here? And I said, because I failed. I give up. I'm done. Now, I'm going to tell you, I wasn't suicidal at this point, but I'm telling you, I was waking up in the morning going, Jesus, if you want to come today, I'm good. If you want to come back, come on. Today's a great day. Let's do it, you know. So I went and she said, your perspective is all wrong. She goes, I don't see someone that's given up. I see someone that is in a firefight and they're losing. So they've chosen to call in the tanks and the close air support. Like you're up in the game. So I went through 2 years of counseling. We actually started a ministry in our church where we were at, another Assemblies of God church. I don't know why God keeps bringing us back to those. It was called the Love Project, and our motto was, I love you because Jesus loves you. And our goal was for people in the church to be the church Monday through Saturday, and to walk up to random strangers, do something nice for them, and then when they asked why, I'd say, well, Jesus loves you, so I love you. And if I love you, I want to bless you and try to open the door. And it really turned out, it was kind of cool what we saw God do with that and kind of grow that and stuff like that. And the whole time I was going through counseling 3 times a week, and then I went down to 2 times a week, and then I went down to 1 time a week, and then I got down to once a month, and I went through 2 years of counseling. We got orders for Detroit, Michigan, back in January this year. And I laughed. I said, God, I'm a hillbilly. I have no business in Detroit. And we kind of fought and kicked with God. And then, God dealt with mine and my wife's heart. And we repented and we said, sorry, Lord, if you want us to go there, we're the light. There's clearly someone there or people there that we need to do something for you. We're sorry that we're being like spoiled children. But we want to go to Pittsburgh. So I hesitate there to tell you that when we were here in 2013-16, we took my pastor from Massachusetts and his 18-year-old son hunting down in West Virginia. And after 3 days of hunting, on the very last evening of our hunt, they both killed their first deer at dark, about a half mile from each other. And we got to track the deer, and we gutted it and processed it and cut it all up, and we did all that. So I don't know, a couple months later, Pastor Dan had called me. He said, listen, I want to tell you, thank you so much for that hunt. And I was like, no, we love to hunt. Thank you so much. He goes, no, you don't understand what you gave me. He said, ever since Sam has been around 16 years old, he went from being my best friend to being my enemy. And he said, ever since that night that we killed those deer, I got my best friend back. So me and my wife, God gave us this vision for a retreat center where we could do stuff like that and where people could come and they could rest if you're in the ministry or something, and wives or husbands and wives or worship leaders or missionaries, where you could come and you could rest for a week, and we would put on hunts and we would do those things. And I remember saying to him, Lord, I'm 42. I don't want to be 82 trying to do a retreat center when? And he said, 4 years. Well, after me and my wife got our hearts right about going to Michigan, the next day my career manager calls me and says, hey, good news. I rescinded your orders from Michigan. You're heading back to Pittsburgh. We returned to Pittsburgh 4 years later, and that's why we're here. And I'm back in the same job. I run a men's group now at my church. So this might stun some of you, but my favorite Jesus in the Bible is violent Jesus, right? I like the Jesus that on 2 different occasions went into the outskirts of the temple where they were changing out money and they were upgrading stuff. So if you don't know that story, like they said, like, hey, to the Jewish people, if you want to get right with God or push your sin off for a year or whatever, you have to make a sacrifice, and it has to be a lamb or a goat or whatever. So basically what the church at the time were doing, they were going down to Walmart and they were buying the goats for $5 each and the doves for $2, and they were bringing them back into the sanctuary area, and they were saying, nah, you have to buy ours, and our doves are $6 and our goats are $15. Oh, and by the way, you have to use our money. And they were robbing people, right? And Jesus got righteously angry. And it says 2 different times he walked into that place and he grabbed the whip off the wall and he started whipping people and he flipping tables saying, you bunch of thieves. That's my favorite Jesus, right? See, there's in the church, and this was always one of my biggest struggles, and I'm going to wrap this back around to our men's group, because our next men's group, our title is Tactical Handgun Training in Jesus, right? The church as a whole, right, has told men, I think for a long time, you can't be violent. You need to be kind. You need to be loving. You need to be peaceful. I believe those things. Don't get me wrong. But the lamb is for the lost and for the Christian. The lion is for the enemy. And we forget to teach that. I heard one time that there's basically 3 different types of people in the world, right? There are sheep, sheepdogs, and wolves. So the sheep is the majority of people in society, right? They have a very amazing capacity for compassion, a very low capacity for violence, and they just kind of want peace, or they want to be left alone. They don't want to do too much. And then you have wolves. Wolves have a high capacity for violence. They have a low capacity for compassion. And they don't care about anyone but themselves, and they prey on the sheep. And then the third one is one of the most unique creatures that God ever created. It's the sheepdog. The sheepdog has this amazing capacity for compassion, but he also has this amazing capacity for violence. And he doesn't care about himself. He only cares about the sheep. He only cares about the sheep. And not only does he run to the sound of the wolf, but he listens for it. So I would say that the church is the sheepdog today. All right? It's us. We're the remnant. And I think that's why you have us standing up against what's going on and being in prayer and violent. Because, you know, the Bible says that ever since John the Baptist, the kingdom of heaven has been taken by violence. But sometimes we don't like to talk about it, Jesus. So it was causing a real, like, identity for me of, like, I know the capacity of violence that I'm capable of, right? And there's other of you sitting here, you're hearing me, and you know what I'm saying, right? But I have this amazing capacity just not to care about my life at all and give it to someone else. But the Christian identity was struggling there until God started showing me that. And he started showing me violent Jesus. And he said, you know something, when it's righteous and it's right, it's okay. Now that's where I walk it out. It's like I'm not Jesus, and I know my anger is not always righteous. So I try to walk that line, right? But I'm telling you, dumb, evil people need to be slapped sometimes, and it's okay. Just make sure Jesus is telling you to do it. That's all I have to say. So that brings us back up to here. So we started this men's group where I'm trying to get men to kind of just to be the men of the church. To stand up in violence against the enemy. When their children get sick, you go lay your hands on them. Yeah. You know, when your marriage is in trouble, fast and go pray. Like, wage war against the kingdom of darkness. You know, the Bible says that like we are to be kicking the gates of hell. I mean, that's pretty bold, right? There's that. And I can tell you, like, I'm a screw up. Like, if I tell you my whole testimony, it'll be filled of faithlessness, screw ups, complete disobedience to God, right? And I'm not talking 10 years ago. But if I tell my testimony from the perspective of God, it's full of success and faithfulness and things. And that's what I have found out. I have literally, I could tell you stories of my daughter falling and cutting her leg and the blood's running down the leg. And I lay my hands on them. And within 5 minutes, it's gone. Because the book of Mark says, and those that believe in my name will lay hands on the sick and they'll recover. I can tell you about a lady in Missouri who hadn't cried for 9 years, and all I did was lay my hands on her, and I didn't pray. And actually, it was Assemblies of God Church again, and they all started praying, and I was like, quit praying. Stop. It's not what it says. Now, it's not the only way to healing, but it's a way of healing, right? And I felt a tear. It was awesome. I felt a tear run down my... Boom. And she was completely healed in that moment. I can tell you about Dehumidifier Joe, this guy that came off of Craigslist to buy a dehumidifier off of me. And he had already lost his right leg. He was diabetic. And this leg from here down was just covered in sores and pus. And he was getting ready to get amputated on. And excuse me for sniffling. And I remember God told me, he said, pray for, it was so funny. I loaded the humidifier up and I'm walking away and in my parking lot. And God says, go back here and pray for his leg. And I remember doing this. I was like, Lord, he's going to think I'm nuts to go back over and ask him to pray. And the Lord says to me, he thinks you're nuts for talking to yourself in the middle of the driveway. Dehumidifier Joe got completely, absolutely healed the next day to the point that, that's God's glory, right? To the point that when he took his bandages off the next morning to treat his wounds and rewrap his bandages, there was nothing there. His leg was completely healed. So what did he do? He wrapped his leg back up and went back to his weekly wound care doctor. And when the nurse unwrapped his leg, she looked down and said, what the? And he goes, I bought a dehumidifier. Doctor came in, had been taking care of him for a year. I was like, what the? He goes, I bought a humidifier. And that guy got saved. And he carried his Ziploc bag of pussy, bloody bandages around with him. And that was his testimony, right? I can tell you about the homeless veteran that I was working with. We were doing a homeless feed out in New Jersey. A guy named David. And he was so infected with something in his lungs that he couldn't hardly breathe and he couldn't hardly speak. And I just told him, I said, if you let me pray for you, my Jesus will heal you. And he didn't want me to put my hands on him because he didn't want whatever he had to infect my children. And I laughed in that moment. I was like, this ain't touching me, man. I'm telling you right now. And I put my hand on his back and on his front. And he went, and it was awesome. He's going, oh, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't talk. Now I can. Now I can. And he looks at me. And I said, don't look at me, man. That's Jesus. Don't look at me. And it was real funny. And I gave him the gospel. And I said, listen, we can pray that prayer anytime you want to. You can pray that prayer on your own. I said, but I'm going to go over here and work. He goes, no, we can pray it right now. I said, that's cool. So we prayed him. And I told him, and I said, now David, the power that is inside of me that just healed you now resides in you. And you can go and do the things that I have done. And I loved his response. He goes, oh, I know just the guy. So I think that's pretty cool. So as I wrap up my testimony here, you don't have to be perfect for God to use you. Right? All you just have to be willing. Be transparent and be willing. All right? Just be honest with God. He knows what you're in bondage to. He knows what you deal with. If you're perfect, go ahead and stand up and we'll exclude you personally, right? But, you know, we all deal with things in our life. We all fall sometimes. We all make mistakes. But the scripture says to run back to the throne of grace. And if you're just willing to walk with him, if he can use a screw-up like me to perform miracles, I guarantee he can use you, probably in better ways and more, right? So once again, thank you all so much for having us today. We're honored to be here, and yeah, thanks.
Hey, thanks for stopping by. This is Pastor Doug. I hope this message helps you grow in your faith and in your relationship with Jesus Christ. But not only that, I hope this podcast becomes a practical way by where your faith not only impacts your life, but the lives of those around you and your community and even your nation. We'd love to see you in one of our services. And here's Will to tell you about local service times and locations. Thanks again for stopping by.
Thanks, Pastor Doug. Living Hope Church is located at 352 Charles Hoke Road in Whitney, Pennsylvania, across from the post office. Our services begin Sunday mornings at 10 a.m., and childcare is provided. For more information, check us out on the web at www.hopealive.net. You can send us your prayer requests and comments to podcast@hopealive.net. Until next time, God bless you from Living Hope Church.